Hello and welcome to the podcast of MoralApologetics.com. We're glad you're here. As always at MoralApologetics.com, our aim is to get you thinking about the moral argument because it has the ability to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. I'm your host, Jonathan Pruitt. On this week's podcast, we hear from Dr. Mark Forman. Dr. Forman is a professional philosopher who specializes in both Christian apologetics and bioethics. And the main topic of this episode is theism as a natural law ethic, and we'll spend some time discussing that. And Dr. Forman will help us understand what a natural law ethic is, why you might prefer it over a divine command theory or any other kind of ethical theory, how it can be applied to moral dilemmas, and even suggest a little bit of how it can be used in apologetics. But also, before we get to that, we get to hear a little bit of a biography from, or I guess autobiography from Dr. Forman, and also hear some of his thoughts about how faith and reason ought to go together. So, a lot in store today. I think you'll really like the what Dr. Forman has to say. And with that in mind, we'll head on over to the at the Jerry Falwell Library and hear what Dr. Forman has to say. Dr. Mark Forman from Liberty University. I wonder if Dr. Forman, if you could just start off telling me a little bit about yourself, maybe your specialization and
Sure. That
kind of thing.
Well, let me kind of give you a little bit of my background, maybe Sure. That to start off there a little bit. I was not originally a philosophy major in my undergraduate courses. I was actually a music education major, and my degree, my bachelor's degree, is in music education.
Oh, wow.
I was actually a choral conducting major and went to Westminster Choir College. So it wasn't until after I got out of college that I began to develop a real interest in specifically in apologetics as a Christian. When I first became a Christian college, I kind of got confronted with a number of questions that I had a difficult time answering, as most of us do, and I decided I didn't want to be stuck in a position where I couldn't provide answers, and so I started to do research in the area of Christian apologetics, and I always had an interest in that. And so when I finally went to seminary, that was the kind of the area that I looked at mostly in seminary, was along those lines. And I studied Christian apologetics in seminary under Norman Geisler at Dallas Theological Seminary many, many years ago. And then after graduating seminary, I taught in a Christian high school for about 7 years before coming here to Liberty University to go through their Master of Arts in Christian Thought and studied. When I came here, Dr. Habermas was here, Dr. Moreland was here, Dr. Geisler was here. Yeah. This was the place to come to study Christian apologetics. Mm-hmm. This is back in 1988, 89. And so I came here to go through their master's program, having already had one master's from Dallas Theological Seminary. And after going through the master's program here, they brought me on faculty to teach. And so I taught Philosophy 201 for a while, and then was asked to take over the biomedical ethics program, a course when Dr. Geisler could no longer teach it. And so I started teaching biomedical ethics, and that became my field. I went to University of Virginia, where I got a Master of Arts and a PhD, and my concentration there was biomedical ethics mm-hmm. in that particular area there. And while going there, I also taught full-time, so it was a kind of going to school part-time of teaching here full-time. And I've been here now at Liberty University for about 26 years, and my major areas of concentration are apologetics and biomedical ethics. I taught those courses for years. Of course, everybody teaches Philosophy 201. We all teach that course here. That's become my major area that I'm teaching this past year. I taught mostly all Philosophy 201, as a matter of fact. But ethics, biomedical ethics, apologetics, those are my major things that I do.
Okay, great. Well, one kind of general question I have for you, too, is what do you see as the connection of philosophy and your faith? How do those things relate?
Well, I very much support the old idea that was around for many years, the idea that, of course, philosophy, theology is the queen of the sciences and philosophy is her handmaiden. Mm-hmm. So philosophy is there to help to support, I think, our theology and our basic understanding of Scripture. And I definitely see that relationship there. I don't think it's faith above reason or reason above faith. I think it's faith and reason together that we need. And I think what we argue for as Christians is for a reasonable faith. And so I think that philosophy helps us on the reasonable side of that, you know, to help us be able to understand how to be able to critically think through things, to be able to formulate arguments for the views that we have, to be able to analyze our theological and biblical beliefs. And so it plays very much a supporting role in, behind my faith there. One thing that I'm very much against, I am against the idea of a kind of a blind faith type idea that we just simply believe because we take some sort of leap of faith or something. I strongly disagree with that idea. I think that we need to have good reasons for what we believe. I think that's what Scripture promotes. I think that's the idea that's behind that. And so that's why I think philosophy really helps to be able to do that.
Yeah, I wonder what you would say about like Alvin Plantinga's Warrant to Christian Belief,
right?
Where you don't necessarily have to have good, like sort of internally accessible reasons,
right?
But you can still have warranted belief. Is that something you'd be in favor of?
Well, I don't think Al Plantinga is wrong. Certainly, you know, I'm not going to sit here and disagree with the great Al Plantinga, and you know, because I wouldn't want to have to face him in a debate on that issue. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But I do. I think this. I think Plantinga is right when it comes to the idea. If somebody was to ask me, do I have good reasons for believing in the existence of God, for example?
Right.
I think I can sit there and say yes, I do.
Right.
Or I can sit there and say, well, I have reasons, but they're not arguments. In other words, I don't think Plantinga is arguing that it's an unreasonable faith. He's arguing, he's simply saying that we have another access to God besides, you know, these arguments, these traditional naturalistic arguments that we present all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our access to God is through some sort of another sense, in a sense, what he calls the sensus divinitas, you know, that we can access God that way, and it operates the same way as our regular senses do. So if I'm asked, why do I believe that you're sitting in the room here? Well, that belief is formed by my sense impressions. I see you, I hear you, I can reach out and touch you.
Right.
You know, well, in the same way, I can have a sense of God. That's what Plantinga wants to say. That's why he believes God is properly basic, just like my belief that you're sitting in the room here is properly basic. I have no problem with that. I think that that's perfectly acceptable, and I don't have a problem with a person saying, I believe in God's existence because I've had this sense of God's presence. However, I'm not sure that has a whole lot of apologetic value.
Okay.
In other words, if somebody else comes along with me and says to me, well, can you give me reasons for why I should believe in God? Well, I don't think I'm going to be very persuasive by saying, well, because I've had a sense experience, you should believe in God. You know, well, maybe he hasn't had that sense experience. And Plantinga is certainly open to that. That's his whole point, is that their cognitive abilities may not be functioning properly to be able to have that sense experience. You know, just like a blind man can't see, you know, a man who's in some way or another cognitive abilities are not functioning properly, he can't have that sense relationship with God. Well, okay, then I don't see any problem with me saying, well, okay, let me give you then other kinds of reasons that at least can give you some sort of belief in the idea of God. And the way I argue for God's existence is I don't try to prove it. As a matter of fact, I try to tell my students to just simply avoid using the word prove altogether. Don't say that, because prove gets this idea of 100%, you know, certain. And it's like, that's not what we're going to do here. So what I try to say is I think that belief in a minimalistic concept of God is the best explanation for certain effects we see in the universe.
Okay.
And by minimalistic, I mean a personal, intelligent, morally perfect creator of the universe. And so I think I can give reasons to believe that that exists. Okay, I'm not saying he's all knowing. Okay, I'm saying he's intelligent. I'm not saying he's all powerful. I'm saying he's powerful enough to create universes.
Right.
Okay, so in other words, I'm going to back off on those aspects of God. It's not like I don't believe those. I do believe God is all knowing and all perfect and all powerful in the traditional orthodox theology of the sense of those words. But that's not what I'm trying to demonstrate. I'm just simply trying to demonstrate that a minimalistic idea, what we mean by God, we have good reasons to believe that that exists. And I think I can give those kinds of arguments to a person. Okay. So for the person who doesn't have that access that Plantinga talks about, okay, that doesn't have that because it's okay, then I think the arguments might work in that particular sense.
Okay.
So lengthy answer here to basically say I'm not an either or with Plantinga's properly basicality argument. I'm a both and. I think it works for us individually. I don't think it works as an apologetic tool.
Okay. So that reminds me of like Bill Craig's showing and knowing distinction that he makes.
Very similar to his idea. Yeah, I think that Bill Craig is right. I think he's right on that, and I agree with him on that, that there's a difference between knowing that that Christianity is true and showing that Christianity is true.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Well, let's talk about how we can use the moral argument to show that Christianity is true. And I know that there are different, like, ethical theories that might undergird this kind of argument. A lot of the most popular ones are more Platonic in their way they're deployed. Like Robert Adams is a Platonist. Dave Baggett. He's more of a Platonist kind of a guy. And, well, Bill Craig, you know, who knows what he is these days, you know. I know you take more of an Aristotelian natural law kind of view.
Yeah, I do.
And I was curious, maybe if you could just explain that first off, what does that mean to say you're an Aristotelian instead of a Platonist?
Right, exactly. Well, that's a very good question, because sometimes I don't think Aristotle and Plato are as far apart as oftentimes they're we kind of give this idea that they're two very distinctly, and they are in some ways different, but I think in some ways they're very close to each other. Both of them believe in some sort of ultimate good behind everything. You know, it's part of it is where they want to locate it. Plato wants to locate the good in the world of the forms, and it's completely apart from this world. And Aristotle wants to say, no, it's part of this world, and he believes in hylomorphism and those ideas there. Okay, the idea that form and matter are together in this world. As far as kind of an Aristotelian, and I would really say more of an Aristotelian / Thomistic natural law. Okay. I want to, because Thomas brings something very important into it. You know, Aristotle, basically, his whole concept of natural law flows from his idea of the four causes. Okay, he believes that everything can be described in terms of four causes. It's material cause, efficient cause, a formal cause, and final cause. And so for him, natural law flows out of the idea of final cause. Okay, the final cause is the purpose for why everything is the way that it is. So, for example, a liver, you know, it has a final cause. Its purpose is to be able to provide certain things for the blood in our system.
Right.
Okay, that's its purpose. As opposed to, for example, an evolutionary materialistic viewpoint, which is the liver doesn't have any purpose. It just happens to do this,
right.
You know, by accident. Aristotle wants to say, well, no, it's designed to do this. But the minute you say designed, you bring teleology into it, you know, and that really is the backbone for Aristotelian Thomistic kind of natural law. Well, now you're going to have some sort of designer in the process of that. So it ties, that's where Thomas brings Aristotle where he really, I think, completes Aristotle. You know, he ties Aristotle's final causes and his four causes into the idea of some sort of intelligent being, a god behind this. So natural law functions only because there's what we call a teleological conception of the universe, that the universe was designed to function a certain way.
Okay.
And God provided these laws, these four causal laws such that it would do that. So things occur because of final causes. Natural law, when we normally talk about what we mean by that, is simply final causation when it comes to human beings. Human beings are supposed to function a certain way, and the natural law is provided to us in order to be able to do that. Now, what exactly is the natural law? Well, for the Aristotelian Thomistic view, natural law is a capacity to do something. It's an ability to do something. It's not content. A lot of people sometimes confuse natural law with content. They think it means we're born knowing right and wrong or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's not what natural law is. Natural law is the idea that we are born with an ability to be able to discover those things that are right or those things that are wrong. And we use the word discover, not determine. Okay, we're not determining right and wrong, we're discovering right and wrong. And we can discover that because we have a rational aspect to our soul, and that rational aspect to our soul can know what the final causes of human beings are. Okay, we can figure out final causes, and then we can know those things that basically promote human flourishing, and those things that are the right thing to do, and those things that another deny or disrupt or devalue human flourishing are the wrong things to do. And so I look at, for example, something like murder, okay, and we say, well, murder is wrong because murder devalues human flourishing, whereas, you know, promoting life, promoting health, good health, and things like that promotes human flourishing. So that's something we should do.
Right.
Okay, that's how the natural law thinking works. But it's all this idea that we are designed to function this way. Okay, and so you need to have that design element to it, that teleology behind it. And that's why it's really, in order for natural law to work, you really have to have a robust view of God's involvement in creation.
Okay. Well, a couple things I want to ask you about that. One would be, I want to come back to the idea of design and nature. But before I do that, I want to ask you if you could say that, like, what's the difference between, like, a divine command theory and natural law? Maybe you could just speak to that difference.
Well, it depends on what kind of divine command theory you're going to have. Yeah. There's a couple of different kinds that are out there right now. The traditional divine command theory is the Occamist version of it. And the Occamist version of the divine command theory is based basically on the concept known as voluntarism. Voluntarism basically says that morality is based on the will of God, that whatever God wills to be good is that which is good. You know, the problem, of course, with voluntarism is it introduces an old problem that goes back to Plato called the Euthyphro dilemma. The Euthyphro dilemma basically is a dilemma where we say, is something good because the gods commanded it to be good and that's what makes it good? Or did God recognize that it's good and he just simply commands that which he recognizes is already good outside of that?
Right.
Of course, and there's that's the chicken and the egg type dilemma that Euthyphro presents us. And it's often presented, by the way, as a puzzle to theists, you know, by atheists. Well, how do you do this and all the rest like that? Natural law basically it rejects voluntarism altogether. Okay, morality isn't based on the will of God. Morality is based on the nature of God. God is a good being. And as a good being, therefore, he commands good things that they flow out of his nature. So his commands are reflective of his nature.
Right.
But his commands aren't the only place where his nature is reflected. His nature is reflected in other places as well. So his nature could be reflected within us. We are made in the image of God. So therefore, I can look upon my image, look inside my image, and determine those things that are right or wrong or good for human flourishing and those things that are bad for human flourishing. And what I'm doing is I'm really reflecting upon the nature of God within me. Because that's reflected. God's nature is reflected there. So I can do that kind of thinking there. And that's how natural law thinking works in that particular sense. So the traditional Occamist version of that, of divine command theory says that it's based on the will of God, and it's just simply whatever God wills is what is right. Well, we all know immediately that the problems of that. If God willed that torturing little children for fun was right, would that now make it right? And we all said that, well, God can't will that, you know, because it goes against his nature. Well, then we say, that voluntarism fails. Essentialism is the best way to go with, which is the idea that's based on the nature or essence of God, who God is. That's what good is. Okay. There are divine command theorists, like Dr. Baggett, for example, who reject the Occamist version of it and go with the essentialist version of divine command theory at that particular point. You know, so what they do is they kind of hook it a little bit into a natural law theory. I mean, I don't think they call themselves natural law ethicists because they see some other issues with natural law ethics they're not comfortable with. But I think that what they've done is they've kind of come down to this idea that if the commands are based on a good God, if it's based on the nature of God being a good being, you know, then he can command, then the commands come from that. Then we can follow his commands that particular way. I don't think it answers all the problems with divine command theory. I mean, there are other issues with divine command theory. What about those people who have not ever heard the commands of God? Where do they get their, you know, where can they get their morality from? Natural law theory says, well, I can reflect upon my human nature and determine those things that are good and such. Divine command ethics, you know, you can't reflect upon human nature. You don't get commands from human nature. So I'm not sure how they answer some of those questions.
Okay. Well, let's go back to this, question of like the connection of design and nature, but I mean, you know, you're familiar with atheists that they say there is a human nature, right, and that certain morals follow from this. In fact, you know, I think that probably most atheists out there probably say something like this, that, you know, humans are like worthy of dignity, or it's human happiness is worth pursuing. Like, so the question then is how. If you're encountering this atheist in a debate, or if you want to introduce theism to this person, how are you going to make the natural law view work as a persuasive, like apologetic argument?
Yeah. I don't know if I would. I don't know personally. I wouldn't appeal to any sort of natural laws in my apologetic argument. What I would do is something like this. I would say, I'm not surprised that the atheist recognizes, okay, morality. That doesn't surprise me at all. Of course he's going to recognize morality. Many atheists are very good people. They're going to do very good things. He's going to agree with me on many of the moral views that I have. You know, he's going to agree that, you know, torturing little children for fun is wrong. And he's probably going to base it on the fact that human beings have some sort of value. That's where the problem comes for me, okay, with the atheist. I don't understand where he has any place where he can ground that value. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's a difference between being able to recognize something and even employ something and being able to account for something. You might recognize my car as being a car. You might even be able to employ it, i.e. be able to drive it. But that doesn't mean you can account for why it exists, okay? In the same way, the atheist can recognize morality and even employ morality. Okay. And being a natural law theorist, I can see why he would do that. Okay, he, like I, is created in the image of God. He doesn't recognize that, but he doesn't. Because he's created in the image of God, he, like I, can recognize those things that promote human flourishing and those things that don't promote human flourishing. Mm-hmm. I mean, he can do the same thing I can do. So, of course, he's going to come to the same morality that I'm going to come to. What he can account for is why there's such a thing as morality. That becomes the problem for me with the atheists. At least I think there is. Okay. Why is there such a thing as right or wrong? Why, where do you get value in a valueless universe? I mean, if you take Dawkins, for example, Richard Dawkins, he'll tell you there is no right or wrong. There is no value. There is no good or bad. There is no evil. All there is just DNA, and we just simply dance to the DNA, as he puts it. Okay? Well, that's fine, but then all of a sudden he wants to turn around and make value statements. He makes value statements about God. God is a horrible person. You know, he tells us, well, okay, that's a value claim about God. How can you make value claims if there is no value in the universe? That to me is the problem. I can account for my natural law. I can account for it by grounding it in a being that is good in and of himself, okay? So what the atheist would have to do is he'd either have to ground it in God, which means he would not be an atheist,
right,
or he'd have to ground it in something else. Some of them ground it in Platonism. They take kind of a Platonic view. They say that good is just a brute fact about the universe, okay? But the problem with this atheistic moral Platonism that some of them ground it into, the big problem with that is that they just seem to beg the question. They don't seem to account for why certain moral properties are associated or correlated or supervene upon certain physical things. Mm-hmm. Why is it that beating a child has the moral property supervened upon it of being wrong?
Right.
Okay. They can't account for that. They just simply say, well, it just is. It's just a brute fact or something like that. You know, and it just bothers me because it's, you know, they blame Christians and theists for taking blind leaps of faith when that's the biggest blind leap of faith of all.
Well, it looks like there's at least two things to explain. One would be the existence of goodness as like this non-material sort of thing, and then the correlation of goodness to certain natural,
exactly, and they have a hard time. I don't think they can account for it either. I mean, I haven't heard a good explanation. I haven't. I mean, maybe it's out there, and I just haven't heard it. And if it's out there, then that's fine. I would like to hear what they'd have to say. But it seems to me, at least when it comes to which is the better explanation, okay, I would say the better explanation is theism. Theism accounts for morality better than atheism accounts for morality. Whichever theory you take. I mean, you know, you don't even have to take natural law. Let's take an ethical theory I don't even agree with, utilitarianism. Okay? Utilitarianism, at its heart, is basically the idea the greatest good is that which promotes the greatest amount of happiness, or the greatest amount of something like happiness, whether it's satisfaction or content or whatever view of utilitarianism. Greatest amount of happiness for the greatest number of people. Okay? And that's because we have a value here. We call it human happiness. Happiness has value. So the utilitarian says, well, the idea is to increase the aggregate amount of happiness in the world. And the right thing to do is that which helps to increase that. That's utilitarian ethics, okay? Well, where do they get the idea that happiness has value?
Right.
You know, where does that come? We just simply pick that. Why? Well, because everybody wants that. Well, just because everybody wants to be happy doesn't give it value. Just because people want something to have value doesn't give it value. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of people, they have this idea, a lot of atheists have this idea that, well, meaning or value, that's just something I find in my life. But yeah, we're asking about its ontological status. Does it really exist? Not just simply, do you want to have it? Okay. And you can find meaning in riding roller coasters. Okay. But that doesn't mean they are meaningful.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so my point would be, again, that they can't account for value. They can't account for how it attaches to certain kinds of things. And I think that to me is problematic.
Okay, well, so here's a question for you. How would a natural law person solve this moral dilemma? So you're probably familiar with this one, about the trolley car problem.
Yeah.
So just to set it up for the people listening, the idea is that you are standing at a train track that's forks, and you have a switch that controls which way the train goes. Right now, the train, if you were to leave the switch where it is, when the train comes, it would, if you leave it where it is, the train will run over four people who are tied to the tracks. But if you switch it, then it will just run over one person, right? So, and your only option is to turn the switch. There's no saving people. The train's coming too fast. All you can do is, you know, turn the switch. So, again, if you don't do anything, four people will die. They'll be run over by a train. And if you pull the switch, one person will die. So I'm just curious, how, as you as a natural law theorist, would you kind of apply your ethical theory to to this kind of moral dilemma?
Well, of course, as we know, dilemma ethics are always the most tough, that's where the rubber meets the road, and we kind of understand that. So let's kind of just look at all the different theories real fast, okay? The utilitarian would say, well, what promotes the greatest happiness? Aggregate happiness. More people will be happier if I save four people than if I save the one. So I'm going to kill the one.
Right.
Okay, that's the typical utilitarian decision on that. Okay, the typical deontologist, a Kantian or something like that, he doesn't know what he's going to do. The problem with Kant, Kant doesn't believe in moral dilemmas. You know, he just doesn't think that they'll either. He either doesn't think they're going to happen or he doesn't seem to give us any ever solution for them. Now, if you take W. David Ross, when he came along, Kantian came along, Ross came up with the idea of prima facie duties. You know, and so he would probably say, I have a prima facie duty to save both lives, but I can't save both lives, so therefore I'm going to be exempted from saving the one that I can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably, regretfully, I'm going to run over the one person and save the four, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Not because of a utilitarian calculation, but because simply the idea that there's four lives involved as opposed to one life involved, okay? And life has value, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to multiply that by four, then we kind of do that. A natural law theorist probably do something similar to that, okay? Natural law theory is a type of deontology, okay? It's going to recognize that there are certain goods in itself. So I would say a natural law theorist is probably going to do something like take a prima facie type view on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, regretfully, there's only so much we can do. You know, so we'll probably try to save the four and sacrifice the one in saving the four. The other option a natural law theorist could do, and I think this is perfectly reasonable, logical, you just simply flip a coin. You know, in other words, I have duties to do both here, and so I flip a coin and I just follow what the coin says.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like running into the burning building and I have two bodies here and I can only save one. Which one do I do? You save the one you can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you do what you can there, so much along there. So, I mean, dilemma ethics is a problem for any moral theory. I don't know of any moral theory that can sit there and say that they have the perfect solution to dilemma. Well, maybe utilitarians would argue that they do have solution to dilemmas. They don't have to worry about moral dilemmas as much.
Yeah.
You know, but everybody else is going to have a problem with a moral dilemma. But that's why today, many, many ethicists now today are trying to steer away from dilemma theories. Dilemma ethics, because dilemma ethics are usually unrealistic type of ethics. We're not saying it's impossible it could happen,
right.
But we're saying that most of my ethical reasoning and decisioning is not about dilemmas, and therefore I should not be basing my major moral theory on some possible rare dilemma I might run into that's going to be difficult for anybody in any ethical theory to
mm-hmm.
decide on. You know, I should be basing my basic ethical theory on my regular day-to-day life and the kind of person I want to be. So,
okay.
By the way, I might comment here. I'm not really 100% a natural law person. Yeah. I'm actually a virtue ethicist.
Okay.
Okay, that's my view. I think virtue ethics is the right way to go. I think natural law supplements virtue ethics.
So then one question would be then, we're thinking about the trolley problem. What would a virtuous person do? Is it? So I'm not sure if that helps or not, but I mean, you're looking to like an exemplar a lot of times in virtue ethics, right?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, you might think, well, what would Jesus do if he was in this situation? Well, he might just, you know, stop the train or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's always hard to use a divine being in that situation because the divine being could cause a miracle and stop the situation from occurring. You know, or the divine being might run over all of them because, after all, he's the master of all life and he determines when life is taken and when it's not taken. I mean, there's all sorts of problems with using Jesus as the model here. That's what I mean. Even a virtue ethicist is going to have problems with a dilemma because there is no, I mean, the whole idea of dilemmas is there is no good solution. You know, there just simply isn't one that's going to perfectly solve everything. You do the best that you can within the particular dilemma and there's not much else you can do.
Well, so here's another, let me just bring up a criticism that some other people might other Christian ethicists might have of natural law. And that would be that because you're appealing to nature instead of directly to God to ground remote ethics, like, I mean, you are appealing to God eventually, right? But you might say there's an extra step involved where we're saying we appeal to human nature, which gets its value from God instead of just appealing to divine commands or something like that, right? Are you like weakening the power of theistic moral arguments by doing that, you think?
Not at all, because I don't think in divine command theory, I don't think you're appealing to God directly. You're appealing to some means of revelation through which God gave you that command. Okay, so you can either appeal to a written form of revelation, let's say scripture, for example, okay, or you're going to appeal to some sort of revelation you've had through your own senses, i.e. maybe like a planting, a kind of sensus divinitas or something like that, both of which are possible, that you could sit there and say, well, I'm not sure maybe I'm misinterpreting scripture here, mm-hmm. maybe it doesn't really apply in this particular way here. I'm not saying scripture is an error, I'm not going to make that claim,
right.
Although it could be, I mean, I'm an errantist, but I could see where somebody says, well, maybe there's a, okay, when God commanded, you know, Joshua to go in and wipe out the Amalekites, maybe that's just wrong. They shouldn't have done that. Maybe God didn't really command that. Maybe Joshua heard God wrong or something mm-hmm. like that. But I'm not saying that. But the point is, certainly one using scripture to apply to a particular ethical situation, they certainly can make an error in that application and an error in that interpretation. You know, so here's my point. God's going to reveal his through a number of different ways. What difference does it make if he's going to reveal it through scripture or to you personally, or if he's going to reveal it through nature?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's still a revelation. Okay. So both of which require my ability to be able to reason and rationally think about and come to a conclusion on. And my reasoning ability, it's not God's revelation that's the error. My reasoning ability can make an error with either of these
yeah.
two. Okay. So I don't see where it's that much of a problem to sit there and say, well, Or it's that much saying, well, the nature thing, that diminishes God's ability or something or another any more than my misinterpretation of scripture or my misinterpretation of the impressions of God or something like that can in some way or another thwart God's purposes or what he wants to do here. Natural law, remember, is, I mean, the version of natural law certainly I'm holding. And there are versions, by the way, of natural law that don't appeal to a God.
Right.
And Phoenix and some other people that have tried to develop a natural law that doesn't do that. I don't think that's successful, personally. But the natural that I'm talking about is based on the idea that God has designed creation a certain way and that we can then look at the way we are supposed to function, those things that promote human flourishing and such, and then reason from those the best thing to do. Okay. You know, that's the basic idea behind natural law. So still coming from God. Okay. It's not like God hasn't done that at all. Okay. But I can make mistakes in understanding that. But then again, I can make mistakes in understanding the other way too.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think that's a great answer. Let me ask you one more question here about natural law ethics. Do you think there's any biblical support for natural law, virtue, ethic view? Well, that's kind of putting you on the spot there, I guess. But
right, yeah. I definitely think that. I think that Romans chapter 2, for example, gives a strong biblical support for mm-hmm. the idea of natural law when it talks about how the Gentiles do by nature the things that, you know, scriptures tell us. You know, it shows that the law is written within their hearts. Okay, I think that's a strong biblical concept of the idea of natural law. Okay. Virtue ethics, I think, is all throughout scripture. Where Paul says, for example, be like me, like I'm like Jesus. And this idea of modeling Christ. I mean, the whole purpose of the Christian life is to model Jesus Christ, to be like him. And that's talking about taking on character qualities like himself. And that's exactly what virtue ethics is about. Virtue ethics is this idea that the foundation behind ethics isn't what I do or the consequences that I achieve. It's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of person that I am. And I should be taking upon myself certain virtues in my life, building those virtues and basically maintaining those virtues in my life to be able to guide me so that I will act out of those virtues. Virtue ethics holds the idea that we act out of the character that we are. That's where our actions come from. Okay. So therefore, we need to make sure that the character is right so the actions are right. Okay. It's not something we just, in other words, it's not like a, you know, there used to be a bumper sticker. I haven't seen it for a while there, but it used to be do random acts of kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of my professors who was a virtue ethicist up at UVA saying, why would anybody ever do random acts of kindness?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, why random? Mm-hmm. Random gives the impression that there's no reason behind why I'm being kind here. I'm just randomly being kind. That doesn't make any sense. But aren't we always supposed to do acts of kindness?
Mm-hmm.
Is it just something we do once in a while? So his whole point is that he disagreed with it. He says, but how do I live a life that I can always do acts of kindness? Well, I need to build a virtue in my life. That's the only way that I can consistently live that way. And that's what virtue ethics is about, is building these characters in our life so that we can be that way.
Yeah.
And so I think that scripture teaches that very strongly, that we're supposed to become certain kinds of persons. When I first became a Christian many years ago in college, the person who brought me to Christ said something to me that was, it's had a huge meaning in my life, my whole life as a Christian. She said to me, always remember that God is more interested in who you are than what you do.
Hmm.
And I always thought, wow, that's virtue ethics. God is more interested in who you are than what you do. You know, so be the right kind of person. And then what you do, that'll come from that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense of the idea, like you said, of being like transformed. Like, what God is concerned about making you into the image of His Son, right?
Right.
And out of that flows certain kinds of actions.
Right.
Okay, well, any other final thoughts on the natural law, virtue, ethics, and so forth?
I think they work together.
Yeah.
I think there's some criticisms of virtue ethics that I think are legitimate. Virtue ethics are very difficult to apply on a practical level. Mm-hmm. They don't help guide me when it comes to sometimes certain moral decisions I have to make. I mean, they help in the sense of it's, you know, okay, if I like a moral dilemma has come up. What do I do in this particular point? The virtue ethics comes along and says, well, be faithful. Be a faithful person. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, that's fine, but how do I be faithful in this? What do I do here? You know,
right.
And natural law, I think, comes along and kind of helps to guide us, to give us a little bit more action principles of things that we should do and such like that, that promote the kinds of things we should promote and not. So I actually think they, like Thomas, okay, Aquinas, mm-hmm. I think they work together. You know, if you look at the Summa Theologica that Thomas wrote, the entire second part of the Summa, the whole part two, which is the largest part of the Summa, is all virtue. It's all about virtue ethics. It's a huge treatise on virtue ethics. And then he has a section in there on the law, okay, and how the law applies that. And he works the two of them together. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, I think those two go together well. So that'll be my final comment on natural law and virtue ethics. So,
well, thanks again, Dr. Foreman, for that very insightful discussion. Make sure you come back next week because we're going to be talking with Dr. Foreman again, but this time we're going to be talking about his specialization in bioethics, and he's going to help us get a Christian perspective on some very important issues in bioethics like assisted suicide and abortion, and I think you'll really benefit from listening to that, so make sure you check that out next week. In the meantime, make sure you visit moralapologetics.com this week because we're going to have content going up from philosophers, from biblical scholars, from literary scholars like we do every week. So I'm sure you'll find something there that you can use. Again, thanks for listening. We hope to catch you back here again next week.